We're going in about 15 minutes. We'll be talking with Stephen Gowans. There's a new book published by Baraka Books. It's called Slouching. I think that's the word, right? Slouching Towards Sirte, NATO's War on Libya and Africa, by Maximilian Forte. We had Maximilian on this program during the no-fly zone, that is to say the NATO bombing zone of Libya, which was in which, by the way, we were lied to A to Z 24 hours a day that it was a no-fly zone and that they had ships in the Mediterranean to prevent arms from reaching Libya. And then we found out via the Ottawa Citizen interviews with the naval captain that they only intercepted any weapons that might be going to the government. Instead, they allowed weapons that were going to racist, extremist armed groups that lynched Africans in Libya. And that was Maximilian Forte who spoke out at the time very forcefully and clearly, while major news outlets such as The Globe and Star and others were carrying this myth and legend of the African mercenaries. So, as I say, we'll talk to Stephen Gowans about that matter, about the book, and of course we'll get Stephen's analysis of the what the situation is not just with Gaza, but the situation in Syria, where, by the way, apparently arming unknown elements, everyone seems to agree, the majority of them extremists of some type, arming them is apparently a sacred duty if you are the government of Ankara or the government of the royal government of Qatar, the royal government of Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, giving weapons and pay, by the way, which is mercenary work. If you give money to someone, you know, a guy walking down the street unemployed and he's young and able, you say, I'll give you $500 a week to kill people, you probably hire a few. And if he does it, he's a mercenary. So hiring mercenaries, that's being done and is being incited by Hillary Clinton and others to have more of that happen. So that's okay. But if the Palestinians lift a finger to defend themselves, suddenly they have to be bombed. The Jerusalem Post today carried an article by the grandson of Ariel Sharon, and he called for the destruction, the flattening of Gazan villages. He says you have to flatten them. I don't mean bomb them. I mean flatten them. And then, by way of illustrating, he said the U.S. didn't stop with Hiroshima. They followed it with Nagasaki. He said, that's the way you win. This is in the Jerusalem Post. So, but I don't hear any Canadian politician getting on his hind legs to complain. So, now another matter we want to make sure we mark. You know what today is? It's, I'll think of it, it's November the 19th, and it is the anniversary of Gettysburg Address on November the 19th, the President of the United States, who was leading a war against the slave states, went to Gettysburg to give a speech. And if you go to the New York Times site today, they always do this day in history. So if you go to that, which I highly recommend, then they will give you the front page of the New York Times report on that event. And of course, we all know there's a sort of quality to this. The speech has become the great American speech, the Gettysburg Address. But in fact, the New York Times only reported that the president was there and said a few words. And they said that what they reported was a prayer in total. It was a nice prayer by some minister who was in attendance. And they also said that there was a tremendous speech given by the main speaker today. They sort of followed the program. They went with the program. The program said, the president will be there. He'll make a few remarks, but the speech is going to be given by so-and-so. And it was an oration. And it went on, I think, they estimate 90 minutes. But what I was impressed with in the New York Times report, and it's something for us to think about, I believe, They said there were, might have been 15,000 people there, and there were soldiers there, and they said that the crowd was completely silent, and so that they could hear the speeches. So, you know, you tend to think 15,000 people, that's going to be a lot of noise. And matter of fact, there's been a lot of talk recently because of the film made by Spielberg about Lincoln, that they say, well, he had a high piercing voice and could break, you know, could reach the back of the crowd. According to the New York Times account, of that speech, people were working to be quiet so that they could hear the address, which is, I'm impressed. I don't think you could, I doubt you could convince people to shut up while Bill Clinton gave a speech. Even, you know, I know they'd call him the big dog and all that. I think that they would talk all they wanted to, actually, because there just isn't that, the weight of the situation is not the same. Another detail that I found, I was doing a little research because I'm not an admirer of Mr. Spielberg's movie, and I found out, I was looking into the Gettysburg Address, there are two so-called colored graves, two soldiers who were colored. They had a brigade, or I should say regiment, I guess it was, the colored forces anyway, in the American Army. These two veterans had died in the 1930s, been buried elsewhere. They were brought there. But for all the bodies at Gettysburg, where they were white. It's a kind of a, and I think to this day they're probably only the two. This year they decided to take time out to honor those two. But that is an important element missing from the Spielberg movie, and that is if Spielberg movie has a kind of a trick in it, it tries to convince you that the most important thing going on in America at the end of the Civil War was the congressional debates, which would be all white people, over whether or not to have an amendment to the Constitution abolishing slavery. And therefore, the only heroes are, of course, various white people, and especially the most famous white guy, Abraham Lincoln. But they didn't arrive at that situation through debates. They arrived at that crisis of, for them, of white power crisis, because they had felt it was necessary to enlist black support for the war and fighters. Lincoln made a fateful decision, and we're all glad he made it, which was to bring African Americans into the army. In order to do that, he had to convince them that it was not just a trick where you go and fight, and then at the end of the war you go back to whatever you were doing. They said, "Well, look, if I'm going to go and fight, and we're going to die, well, you know, we're living in a country that still hasn't gotten rid of slavery." So Lincoln, it was the two things, the decision he needed those troops, and he ended up with hundreds of thousands of black soldiers. By the way, something very, it's a big secret in American history, not widely known. I consider myself educated. I didn't find out till I did my own homework. No teacher of mine ever told me that there were tens of thousands of black soldiers who and deaths in the war. But the price of that, Lincoln found, of course, was that he had to engage with black leaders, most importantly, the man named Frederick Douglass. Now, Frederick Douglass went out on his own, you know, he put his reputation on the line to say to black former slaves or escaped slaves, or to the so-called freedmen, go in the army and serve, and at the end of the day, we're going to have political freedom. So he risked his reputation. And others, of course, together with his own son, risked their lives, and they faced a place called Fort Pillow. They actually, the blacks were captured, and the Confederates said, "We don't recognize black prisoners," and they massacred them. killed every last one of them because they shouldn't have been there, according to the slave state people. They wanted to teach them a lesson. So Frederick Douglass did all that. He and his black allies helping Lincoln. So that's how they arrived at this little debate about, well, you know, shall we have an amendment? Now, on the day of his second inaugural, which is portrayed in the film, second inaugural of Lincoln's election to President of the United States, Douglass went and stood to hear what Lincoln was going to say because, you know, he made a lot of promises. He liked the speech. It was a great, if you have never seen any, Lincoln was a brilliant speaker, mainly brilliant because he wrote and spoke like an intellectual, not like people make him out. He was a very thoughtful speaker, and you had to listen very closely. So Douglass heard the speech, and he was so excited, like others, that when the speech was over and it was time to have the celebration over at the White House of the inaugural address, he hurried over. And he got in line, like of others. And in those days, you could go visit the White House. And, of course, prominent people were taken inside. They shook hands with the president and had a cocktail or whatever it was. And so Douglass goes, and he gets to the door, and he is stopped by the security. And the security says there are no colored allowed in. But he said, well, I'm Frederick Douglass, he told them. He thought that might help. And then, he knew all kinds of political leaders. And half of the, Lincoln's party made up about half of them were what we call abolitionists. They had no problem about citizenship and abolition and the whole thing. So he was a smart guy. He muscled his way, part muscle, part brain. He got himself through the door. They were still not going to let him in when some others said, hey, just tell Lincoln he's here. So, okay. So they word gets to Lincoln. Next thing you know, Douglass is taken right into the room where Lincoln and others are sitting. Lincoln sees him. It's a very important moment, which Mr. Spielberg didn't want to share with us. I don't know why. Lincoln says, there's my friend Douglass, and stands up. So everybody, of course, shows a little deference. And so then Douglass goes over, and he said, I don't want to take your time. I just want to shake your hand. So Lincoln said, well, okay, but I want to know what you thought. But this is all covered, by the way. There are people who are sitting there, and Douglass put this in his memoir. So then he says, well, what did you think of my speech? And Douglass said, I don't have time to talk about your speech. I feel I'm taking your time. And Lincoln said, if there's anybody's opinion I want, it's yours. Tell me what you think. And he said, I thought it was, I can't get the exact words, it was like sacred. He said, well, I'm glad to hear you say that. And then Douglass said he made his way out. Now, here's the part that I would suggest if Spielberg, if you had a brain and you had a heart and you were paying attention, you want drama? Frederick Douglass goes to see the president, can't get in, barely gets in, talks to the president, etc. There's a guy emotionally torn up, in my opinion. Frederick Douglass must have been highly torn at what he'd been through and what his people had been through. But here's the punchline for me. I didn't notice that Lincoln said, why don't you stick around and have a drink? He didn't say, hey, you're here. You don't have to go anywhere. You're Frederick Douglass. But no. Yes, go. So that's the reality that Spielberg didn't care. He wasn't interested in it at all. Instead, at the close of the film, we have Lincoln giving the address. And by the way, they make the picture so that there are many black people standing behind him on the podium. I think that must be false. I don't think any way there was a... There might have been one or two, but there was certainly not a crowd. And so that's just liberal propaganda. They want us to say, oh, and then after that, everything was fine. All that happened was 100 years of repression driven by the Klan. 100 years before the 1960s. And they fight for the actual rights as opposed to the paper rights. So, yeah, that was, in my opinion, the man is misleading us with this film. It's seriously misleading. Anyway, all that is known, and I think we should make sure that when people talk about that film, say, yeah, they debated that. And it was an interesting parliamentary exercise. But if they had not recruited the hundreds of thousands of black soldiers to make sure they won the war, if that had not happened, there wouldn't have been any silly debate or discussion And as likely as not, the country would have been split in two pieces, one half slave, the other half waiting to become slave, I guess. Anyhow, I think we can take a break. This is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us on the web, taylor-report.com, and we'll be right back with Stephen Gowans. And we're back. Taylor Report. And I'll just tell you again, it's at taylor-report.com. By the way, we're back up to speed. We had been we had a little period there where we were behind our time, as the man said in Dickens. We're, I think, in sync. If we're not, write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and tell us how we can improve the situation. Again, we're going to be talking shortly with Stephen Gowans and the book that we're going to ask him about, and we're going to ask him, of course, about the situation in Syria. The book is Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa, and the author is Maximilian Forte, and it's Baraka Books. By golly, I think we already have Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello.
Hello. Stephen, I just mentioned, I want to make sure, on your site, that's gowans.wordpress.com, right?
Correct.
You have written I'd say for you, an enthusiastic review of a book by Mr. Maximilian Forte, Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. You say this is the best you've seen, and you doubt that it's going to be improved upon. Tell us what's in this book that you think probably most Canadians don't know.
Well, first I have to ask you why you thought for me that it's enthusiastic.
Well, you have a very cerebral approach to matters, and and very careful about how you assess things. So I'm calling it enthusiastic. I might be off, but I'm going to give you a B on enthusiasm.
Well, I acknowledge that I am enthusiastic about it. I think that it's a great book, mm-hmm. and it's a great book for many, many reasons. But it's a searing indictment of NATO's military and intervention in Libya, but also of the North American and European left that supported it. Forte has written in great detail about this, but you're not overwhelmed by the detail when you read it. I mean, it's as I said, I just can't imagine that anyone's going to write anything that's better than this.
Yeah. Well, you know, Stephen, I recall we spoke to you. And matter of fact, at some point during this, attacks on Libya and the what they euphemistically called the no-fly zone, the headlines were pretty, and the stories were running almost daily with a backstory of African mercenaries coming in by the thousands, brought in by Gaddafi, and we noticed that it was remarked on that there were, as you said, there were people who called themselves left and progressive and whatnot who were repeating those stories.
Yes, there were, and and there was no evidence that has ever been marshaled to show that, in fact, that there were African mercenaries. But I recall at a time there was a fellow who was kind of like a self-designated expert on African affairs from a left perspective, and he claims his expertise because he lives in South Africa, so that somehow makes him an expert on all matters African.
Yes.
And at the time he wrote that he wrote something that suggested that Gaddafi had very limited support, and the only reason that he was carrying on or hanging on was because he had the support of these sub-Saharan African mercenaries, many of whom, he said, came from Zimbabwe, and he even specified a price. They were receiving $16,000 per person.
Mm-hmm.
Forte mentions this. He doesn't point to any names, or he doesn't name names. I do name names in my review. There was one person in particular. He read the review, and he was exceedingly irritated that I pointed this out. And although he insists that indeed there is evidence that there were mercenaries, but he's unable to produce any.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, there's a whole number of levels in which many of us are disappointed in so-called progressive institutions and whatnot. And the first one is merely there should be a standard of respect for facts, no matter what your ideological point of view. I mean, how can you expect anybody to regard you seriously if you don't address facts or help assess what the facts are?
Well, that's correct, absolutely. And again, that's one of the attractions of this book. I mean, it does go through the facts and show how, when you marshal the facts and all the evidence of the story that was put forth by NATO and Western governments and by a large section of the left, was completely fallacious.
Mm-hmm. This is, by the way, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com, where you can read this review and other articles to do with some of these events that we want to talk to Stephen about today. I wonder about this phenomenon. It's moved to Syria at the moment. We've spoken in the past about it, but the people who seize power in Libya seem to have a really visceral hatred of the government of Assad. I don't see them showing the same attitude towards in support of the people of Gaza. I mean, there's a kind of vortex developing here. I wonder, are you curious about this? The armed movement of the no one seems to, everybody agrees they don't know who the Syrian rebels are, or at least they claim not to know. But they all talk about it as being totally sacred, the assassination of leaders, the murder of reporters, the blowing, setting off car bombs in civilian neighborhoods. That's sacred, according to, as near as I could tell, Ottawa and elsewhere. Then when they look at Gaza, the slightest effort on the part of the people there is considered criminal by at the moment it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help us say why is that going on?
Yeah, well, if we remember, I mean, the connection between Gaza and Libya, if we remember that there's a great line at the end of Forte's book, which is, the next time that empire comes calling in the name of human rights, please be found standing idly by. And you'll recall that support for the intervention in Libya was galvanized by this story of Gaddafi threatening to unleash a massacre in Benghazi, and some even went so far as to say a genocide, which didn't happen and wouldn't have happened because, for one, Gaddafi didn't have the military resources to be able to hunt down rebels door to door, and another reason was because he never really said that he was going to massacre people in Benghazi. He threatened those who had taken up arms and also offered an amnesty if they laid down their arms. But there was this concern that there was going to be a massacre in Libya, so we all had to do something. We had to support this intervention. Well, there's a massacre going on in Gaza right now. I mean, the last I looked, there were 90 Palestinians dead. Mm-hmm. Three Israelis dead, 700 Palestinians wounded. I mean, this is a massacre, and yet I don't hear anyone saying we can't stand idly by while this massacre occurs, although we said that over Libya. I mean, so there's an obvious double standard. No one said that we could not be found standing idly, or that we could not stand idly by when a massacre, the last massacre happened in Gaza a few years ago. It was Operation Cast Lead.
Stephen, I was just at the top of the show. I was speaking to David Heap, who's been part of the GazaArc.org group, and he was tried to break the Israeli blockade. And I asked him, and I need to ask you too, where is the evidence that Ottawa and Washington and Paris, London, where's the evidence that they actually want a ceasefire and recognition of Palestinian rights, for example?
The evidence that they want that?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, they're continually, like today's Globe and Mail, the headline is, and this is comical to me, I mean, it says, world works, you know, good old world, world works for a ceasefire as Israel-Hamas trade blows. Well, ceasefire perhaps, but where's the evidence that they actually want to get this matter resolved politically? I know that Jimmy Carter has become persona non grata for actually seeming to go and be something like an honest broker, but I don't see Obama actually caring whether or not the Palestinians live under the Israeli boot forever.
No, and I guess it depends on how you define resolving the issue. I mean, from the perspective of Ottawa and Washington and London and Paris, I think resolving the issue means the Palestinians capitulating and allowing more and more of their territory to be eaten up and stolen by Israelis year after year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are they interested in resolving this? I don't think so. I mean, they're simply interested in the Palestinians giving up.
Yeah. You know, that raises a question, too, and apropos Syria and this question. I get the impression, for example, that Hillary goes to Doha, where the Emirates and the Gulf states arrange for her to talk to the so-called Syrian opposition, and she provides a kind of political leadership. And if they were to announce tomorrow, which doesn't seem to me be possible, but if they were to say, well, you know, maybe some of these third parties have a point, we'd like to have a meeting with Assad and we would like to arrange a ceasefire, I get the impression that Hillary would fire them all.
Yeah, I mean, no one in the West is interested in having any kind of resolution with Assad, in which the Assad government or the Ba'athist government remains. I mean, the objective is to unseat that government, to overthrow it, and to install some kind of government that is ductile and, you know, congenial to promoting U.S. interests. So no one's interested in resolving the dispute except in wiping away the Assad and Ba'athist government. That's the only possible outcome that those that Western powers are willing to accept.
Yeah, and this raises, I guess it's maybe this writer Glenn Greenwald, you must be familiar with his work, he's been raising this point that even on the level of it used to be this the signature work of the Israelis that they would assassinate people, particularly Palestinian leadership over the years. And he said, this came up because this Gazan militia leader, who had been apparently part of negotiations with the Israelis, he gets assassinated.
Uh-huh.
And people say, well, maybe that wasn't wise and someone should criticize Israel. And Glenn Greenwald said, well, how can you do that? Because the United States now is part of the official doctrine that they will assassinate anybody they want using drones.
Well, that's true. I mean, they have their hit list, or Obama has his hit list, doesn't he? Including a hit list which includes American citizens on it.
Mm-hmm.
I know. So they've taken, the U.S. has taken a page from the Israeli book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We just assassinate whoever it is we need to assassinate.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com, and it's always great writing there and analysis. And Stephen's been writing about, of course, the situation in Libya, Syria, and Gaza. I noticed something which seems to me new. About 2 weeks ago, maybe three, I believe it was the Emir of Qatar visited Gaza, and it was all accounts of it were rather curious. He arrived there and said that he was going to provide, money for reconstruction or some such thing. I forget what it was, mainly promises, but money. And they said that there was going to be a rally to receive him and show appreciation at a soccer stadium. However, they said attendance was so low that when he found out there was nobody in no big crowd, he decided not to go. So they called it off. But I'm interested in the fact that he was there. That's pretty heavy for him to show up. And today, Turkey is talking about how they're very much with the Gazans. And, of course, we're hearing things from Egypt. But Turkey and Qatar are mainly responsible for the money and arms and training that's going on in Syria for the rebels in Syria, so-called.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have another narrative, which I guess I want to ask you about the narratives going on here. The Israelis keep talking about Hamas as though they are an arm of Iran. And when the first hit Israel, they said, oh, those are Iranian-made. They made several times the Israeli leaders, those were Iranian-made rockets that hit us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it looks to me like we have a pretty narrow door here. We can't all go through it. What's going on? Iran, Turkey, Qatar, who are not fond of each other. have you got an idea what's going on? And by the way, Hamas has basically moved away from Iran. They moved out of Syria. And many have been clucking their tongues about the quality of their leadership. So at this very moment of confusion over who's with whom, the Israelis attack. But why are we seeing this from Turkey and Qatar, particularly this heavy thing of the leader going to Gaza?
Mm-hmm. Well, there do seem to be sectarian divisions here. And I know one's not supposed to mention them, and they're not often mentioned. But, I mean, there do definitely seem to be sectarian divisions. I mean, divisions between Sunnis and Shia. When you consider Iran as Shiite, and that Syria or the Assad regime relies on support from the Alawi, which is a part of Shia Islam. And then, I mean, you seem to see a lot of this, you know, whether you're on the Syrian side or against, or the Syrian government side or the Iranian side or against them, seems to have a little bit to do with whether you're Sunni or Shia in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, I mean, these are all interesting cases. I mean, they're all supporting the Syrian rebels.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all supposed to believe that the Syrian rebels are fighting for democracy. And yet, I mean, we have a movement in Jordan against the Jordanian monarchy, the dictatorship there, which says we need to overthrow this monarchy and establish democracy. Well, the United States isn't interested in supporting the Jordanians, mm-hmm. nor are they interested in supporting the Bahrainis, who want to overthrow the monarchy, or at least establish some kind of democracy there. Not interested in them. Not interested in supporting those in Saudi Arabia who want to overthrow the absolutist monarchy there. And yet they claim to be interested in supporting democracy in Syria.
Yeah, it's getting to be more and more of a stretch, isn't it? I mean, by the way, I see stress and strain in the New York Times and the Globe and Mail and others because they have to keep all these balls in the air. And the ordinary pedestrian has a problem. When he says, well, your favorite armed groups, and matter of fact, you say you don't like terrorists, but the guys in Syria are by definition terrorists, and they're fine. But if they're in Gaza, they need to be bombed. It's the media are starting to have suffer from schizophrenia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, then there's the issue. Yeah, terrorists. Well, we could call the Israeli military terrorists as well, and the U.S. military terrorists as well. I mean, if you define terrorism as using violence to force civilians to pressure governments to behave differently, then by definition, I think the U.S. military, the IDF, they're terrorist forces as well.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, a great review of the new book from Baraka Books by Maximilian Forte, Slouching Towards Sirte, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. There's a number of things. Well, I probably should take advantage of the fact that we're talking to somebody who has a global view when he talks in analysis. I have to ask you, moving to Asia, I'm seeing a lot of reports of serious confrontation between Japan and China, together with news that Japan is about to redefine its defense force into a true army and navy. I'll bet you're following that closely. Can you tell me is it as dangerous as it sounds? I guess one thing would be, who's responsible for this confrontation over these small islands? Somehow big wars seem to start with little islands. Who's responsible for that?
Well, I mean, there are a number of players involved. And you have all this dispute over these small islands in the South China Sea or in that area. And there does seem to be, if you look at this from a broader perspective, you do see the United States trying to align with various countries in the neighborhood of China to establish a kind of bloc against China. It's not only done in forging military alliances, but also in this Trans-Pacific Economic Partnership, which, if you recall, Canada wanted to get involved in as well, which is just like a kind of trade arrangement between Canada, the United States, and various Pacific countries, which excludes China. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be motivated in the United States by the fact that U.S. businesses are missing out on a lot of opportunities in that region, and U.S. businesses would like to get back in. And the reason they're missing out on those opportunities is because they were being displaced by Chinese enterprises. But there does seem, I mean, this is the U.S. pivot toward the Asia Pacific, right?
Mm-hmm.
And which obviously is directed at containing China. It's so clear that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure why Washington bothers denying it, because I don't think that they can provide a credible denial.
Mm-hmm. In terms of commerce, if we were just strictly speaking in their old language of free trade and whatnot, isn't the U.S. prepared to sacrifice Canada a bit here? I mean, Canada can actually seem to be in a position to benefit from serious trade with China. If this stuff keeps going the way it is, Canada will be short of some business, right?
Yes.
So we'll be sacrificed for U.S. policy.
Yes. It wouldn't be the first time.
Don't tell the parties in Parliament. That just makes their life miserable. But, I mean, that would be true, right? That actually this is a great power telling a medium power, we're going to do this. It may cost you some money.
Yeah. and that's, sure. And, I mean, the United States has been doing that with its allies with respect to sanctions against Iran and the question of where you're going to buy your oil. I mean, you had all these, not all, but many U.S. allies that were relying on Iran for their oil. If you recall, the mm-hmm. U.S. government approached them and said, you're going to have to stop buying oil from them, which wasn't to the benefit of those countries, obviously. So they had to make sacrifices on behalf of this U.S. plan to wage economic warfare against Iran. So,
cut off our nose to spite our face.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Stephen Cowens, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciated that review of Slouching Towards Certe, NATO's War on Libya and Africa, published, written by Maximilian Forte and published by Baraka Books. And Stephen Cowens is gowens.wordpress.com. And thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That covered a lot of the real estate, didn't it?
It certainly did.
Hey, I think we might have an announcement. I'm going to try to beat the clock here with something. I said it today is November the 19th, the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. To show you how long and tiring his address was, I'm going to read it to you since it is very short. And just imagine that I sound like Bill Monroe of the Kentucky Bluegrass Inventor, because that was the way Abraham Lincoln actually sounded, like Bill Monroe. And it goes like this. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, no long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, and that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. That was Abraham Lincoln.
2 minutes.
On the Gettysburg Address. And that's a very liberating speech, because if you learn the words, you could say to any American, particularly the guys who put on the white sheets, hey, you lost. It's of the people, by the people, for the people, and that... all men are created equal. And, of course, he got that from Jefferson. And it's true. These guys, you could say they're hypocrites, they're liars, but okay. But you can take that, you got it, put it under their nose and say, guess what? I'm here to collect. It was a great moment. And despite the failure of, the latest Hollywood guy to get it right, we'll be talking about that and other things. Today, we were talking to David Heap. We really appreciated. He was in Paris working hard with the GazaArc.org. And, of course, we spoke to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. I mentioned the name Glenn Greenwald. There is a brilliant American writer who's helping all of us. This question I put about Canadian politics and all that is traceable in origin to... Glenn Greenwald put in that question, are we interested in a peaceful settlement? Are we interested in justice for the Palestinians, et cetera? Never mind whether the two parties are. How about us? And he's put everybody on the spot. So Carol, thanks very much. Oh, you have one more announcement? We have a moment for that?
Two more announcements.
Go ahead.
One is that tomorrow evening it'll be a book launch at Quattro Books, which is at 382 College Street in their new bookstore cafe called Q Space. And there'll be five authors, including our friend Jana Patriarca, who, of course, has been on the Taylor Report a number of times. And also at Betzatun on Saturday at 7 p.m., the film Lack on Palestine, which Mike Kulboom is the filmmaker. It's called An Essay on Film, and it talks using archival footage. He talks about how the language of Palestine has been framed by filmmakers. So it's kind of a historical film. So That'll be Betzatun on Saturday evening.
Okay. And I have a note. Paul Lucas Abagina sent me a message today that the United Nations Security Council has condemned Paul Kagame for his role in the massacres that are taking place in the Congo. I take that. I'm going to call that just news. I'm not terribly enthused about the Security Council.
But they nonetheless, they get to stay on the Security Council nonetheless, right?
You found out. You listened to the Tate Report. Carol, thanks very much. Phil Connor, thanks very much. And we'll see you next week.